Hello and welcome to Sit for Speech, the podcast for professionals in public finance. We're talking all things health and social care integration this episode, focusing on the recent NHS white paper on integration. We have a range of experts from health and local government joining us to share their thoughts this week. Stay tuned for Manchester City Council CFO Carol Culley, as well as author and journalist Nick Timmins. But up first is sitting Sit for President and CEO of University Hospitals, Coventry and Warwickshire NHS Trust, Andy Hardy.
Hi Andy, thanks for joining us again on Sit for Speaks. It's been a while since we've had you on the show. How are things going in the NHS world?
Well, I'm pleased to say that we've definitely seen a big reduction in numbers in relation to the COVID pandemic. And in my hospital now, in terms of inpatients, we're at less than 2% of our peak. And this means that we're really starting to think about restoring and rebuilding services, backlogs of elective patients, et cetera, at the same time as thinking about the health and wellbeing staff and giving time to rest, et cetera. But due to vaccinations with the combination of the lockdown, we're definitely seeing positive effects and can look forward to coming out of lockdown, the different phases alongside the roadmap.
So turning to the focus of our conversation today, the NHS white paper on health and care integration. Integration has been a hot policy topic for some time, and one of the takeaways from the pandemic has been closer collaboration between health and social care, and essentially barriers coming down by necessity. So before we get onto the white paper itself, Andy, what do you think have been the barriers to integrated care in the past? And has the pandemic, in your view, been any kind of catalyst for doing things differently?
I mean, there's been a number of barriers, I think, in the past. I think principal among those has been financial barriers, which, of course, is relevant to those of us members in SIT for wherever we sit, whether we're in the health sector or social care sector. We've seen some of those financial barriers come down during the pandemic. We've also seen organisational barriers, which I sometimes call, you know, organisational ego, actually. But if we think about some of the financial barriers, and it really relates to one of my key themes as president this year around the one public pound. So we're starting to say, ask ourselves, you know, how can we spend each pound most effectively for the population we serve within our areas rather than, oh, health are funded for X, social care is funded for Y, et cetera, and never the twain shall meet or we can't cross money over. I think we've seen the urgency associated with the challenge that the pandemic has brought has meant that we've not been asking those questions. We've just been saying, right, what do we need that's best? We'll sort the money out later. And I'm certainly hoping that as we move forward and the white paper will give us this opportunity, we start to think more about that public pound. Where do we spend our money best? Not just say this is a health pound or this is a social care pound. This is where the cost should sit. This is where income lies. Let's just do things right, then sort the money flows out and not have those disincentives to change.
Now, it's worth noting that we'll be speaking to him later this episode, but we're definitely keen to hear your views on this. In a recent blog for the Institute for Government, Nick Timmins recently said that the proposals in the white paper, quote, threaten to take the NHS back to the wrong sort of future. What are your thoughts on Nick's statements?
Yeah, okay, thanks. I mean, what Nick was referring to there was that the white paper talks very much around re-establishing Whitehall or ministerial control over the NHS. He was saying, because that was scrapped largely in the 2012 Health and Social Care Act from Andrew Lansley. And he is saying that he thinks that is a backward step, having direct control over, and that the independence of NHS England or NHS England Improvement is now is important. And he thinks that's a backward step. I think I see where he's coming from. But of course, the NHS is always going to be under some form of political control because they are paymasters and this is a political arena. Nick also goes on to talk about, actually, some ministers don't need to be aware there, because that means that if you centralise control and it's directly linked to ministers, then ministers can get the blame if anything goes wrong. I think a level of independence from NHS England is important, but as Simon Stevens, our chief executive of NHS England, has pointed out, it's rare that there is a disagreement between what is right for health service between ministers and the NHS, but the NHS does need to have an independent voice to say what it thinks is right for the patients we serve. I suppose if I do have a concern that slightly echoes what Nick was saying, is that it's probably okay when we've got such a leader as Simon Stevens, who is very adept at dealing with politics and politicians. A different leader might be more susceptible to direct, almost control. So I do think there a level of independence is required for NHS England. So on that, for that degree, I do agree with Nick's comments and concerns.
Right. And is there anything that you think should be welcomed from the proposals?
I think there's a lot to be welcomed. I think the key things are in relation to having explicit acknowledgement of the importance of integration and health and social care working together for the populations we serve. Within the white paper, having specific governance arrangements that bring in the local authority into integrated care systems and giving them an absolute recognised seat at the top table.
Now, we still don't have full clarity on the governance and accountability arrangements that will underpin the proposed two-board structure. What impact do you think this will have on the relationship between the NHS and local government? And do you have any reflections on what an effective governance model might look like?
Okay, thanks. So I think firstly, just for listeners who may not be fully aware of what has been proposed in the white paper, you just talk about each integrated care system having two boards, one which in effect is an NHS-only board, looking at the workings of the local NHS, and then one is really like a ICS place board, which involves the wide local government partners in looking at the overall health and well-being of that population. I think on one level, it's really good, as I mentioned earlier, in terms of it's very clear and explicit that the local government should have a seat at the table of an ICS governance board. But there's always then the challenge, whenever you've got two boards, which takes primacy, if any, where do the key decisions get made? I think one of the fears from local authority colleagues, which I understand, is that actually all the real meaty decisions are going to be made at the NHS-only board, which is going to be predominantly made up of NHS executives. We need to ensure that isn't the case, because it's very clear, and again, going back to the pandemic and the whole issue around health inequalities, which have been further widened due to the pandemic, that we need to make sure that the local authorities who actually oversee a lot of those issues actually make the biggest difference to reducing health inequalities have an equal say and an equal vote.
And kind of looking towards the political component of this, the next steps will be for government to start pushing legislation through Parliament. What are the key considerations for the debate going forward?
I think for me, it's getting that governance model right so people know where decisions are going to be made. I'm very clear and keen that whatever the final legislation looks like, it needs to be permissive rather than prescriptive. I think whilst some level of general setup for ICSs is understandable across the whole of the country, it's really important that local leaders from both health and social care can actually shape how its ICS looks. So that's what I mean by it needs to be permissive rather than too prescriptive about how you have to do everything down to the nth degree in every level and every area.
So for any parliamentarians that happen to be listening to SIPA speak, you know, the key takeaway is permissive, not prescriptive.
It is for me, absolutely, yes.
That's all we have time for today. Andy, thank you so much for the time.
Great, thank you.
Some interesting reflections there from Andy. Later in the episode, we'll be joined by Nick Timmins, who will be giving his thoughts on the white paper. But first up, we have Carol Cully from Manchester City Council to give the local authority view on the matter.
So it's my very great pleasure to welcome Carol Cully back to the podcast for her second appearance. Thank you very much for joining us, Carol.
Thank you.
How's lockdown been treating you, Carol?
There are some real benefits to working from home and some real boost to productivity, but equally I miss going into Manchester, I miss meeting people, and I miss the energy you get from bouncing ideas off people. And there's always the lockdown dog experiences, aren't there, which are also fairly infamous in Manchester for me.
No, absolutely. I completely understand that. And I think a lot of people are starting to share that feeling. It's not quite the same being able to have these sort of conversations virtually. After all, the last time you joined us on the podcast was face to face. So as convenient as this might be, the journey up to Manchester was rather nice. Nice to get out and about as part of your job. So Carol has kindly joined us today to talk about the NHS white paper into health and social care integration, and Carol will kindly be speaking to it from the local government perspective. The integration has been a hot topic for some time, and one of the takeaways from the pandemic has been closer collaboration between health and social care, and barriers very much kind of coming down by necessity, I suppose. Before we get on to the white paper itself, what do you think have been the barriers to effective integrated care in the past? And do you think the pandemic has been any kind of catalyst for doing things differently moving forwards?
I'm talking about this from the context of Greater Manchester, of course, where with the devolution arrangements, there has been a real drive for closer integration, both for commissioning arrangements and provider relationships for delivering particularly community-based care on the ground. That said, it's all been a lot harder than perhaps it needs to be. Some examples, the NHS planning cycle is so different from the local authority budget process. You've got very different cultures, you're bringing together non-exec structures and very clearly defined processes with the importance of local democratic roles and members. We operate, this is a bit of a boring comment to make, but it's one that is the bane of my life at times. We have different VAT regimes and different performance frameworks. So in some ways, the integration has been happening in places despite of rather than because of the push to encourage integration. I think the role of whole population health and that focus on place, so you're not just looking at the health interventions, is really, really important, and I'm passionately committed to that. I think the pandemic has been a real force to cut through some of that, cut through some of that crap, and to really make things work, because you have to make things work. Whilst I thought we had good sort of integration partnership arrangements prior to that, I think that's really reinforced the importance of whole system working and the implications if you don't tackle one part of that system. And the pandemic has driven some very different ways of working. It's brought its challenges, but there are thoughts around more digital-based primary care, for example, how models could look different in the future. And we're using it in Manchester as very much a catalyst for sort of looking at the white paper, looking at the learning from the pandemic, and how we can really build on that rather than going back to where we were, if that's ever possible, 12 months ago.
I think going back to any kind of normal is going to be possible. It very much feels like one of those moments in history that's changed things fundamentally. I've often said that it feels like I'm living through a future GCSE history question.
And as a student of O-level history in my day, I can imagine the questions forming now.
So you touched there upon the kind of some of the challenges in the relationship between the NHS and local government, just from the culture standpoint, different regimes. I mean, going on to the white paper specifically, when SIPFA initially responded to the consultation on the proposals, one of the things we noted that local government was kind of consistently referred to as this kind of amorphous mass and no real kind of recognition of the different tiers and the different stakes that different bits of local government were going to have in the integration agenda. As a CFO in the sector, what do you feel like consultation on the proposals has been like up to now? And do you think that local government has been sufficiently included in the development of the proposals that have now come to light?
I think there are some things in the white paper, start with the positive, that are really welcome. You know, some of that move away from the purchaser-provider split, that real focus on how do you integrate care at a place level. I think some of those messages are really, really welcomed. I think the role of local authorities isn't necessarily fully understood. Sometimes it's seen through a social care lens rather than the importance of whole population health. If we're going to have really sustainable health and social care arrangements in the future, then there needs to be genuine co-design and recognition of what local government can bring to this. That wider experience of tackling health inequalities, for example, is going to be critical as we move through and move out of the pandemic. I think local government is seen as a stakeholder, as you say, as a bit of an amorphous mass, without the recognition that different tiers of local government are different and what we can bring to the table. And it's an amorphous mass, not just nationally, but we're not necessarily an amorphous mass unless it's a very small ICS in an integrated care system either. I think there needs to be a focus on is how within an ICS decision making will really work, both at an ICS footprint and at a locality level. And that's where local government can bring some real experience to the table.
So you talked there about the role of local government and the role of sort of that local approach in place-based care, I suppose. So some have raised concerns that the proposals in the white paper represent greater government centralisation of health and care services. Is this something that you'd be concerned about?
Yes, it's something I'm very concerned about. I think there's always, this is oversimplifying, and anybody who knows me knows that I oversimplify drastically all the time. But the NHS is a much more command and control system with its route back into central government and the Secretary of State, whereas local government is built much more on local democracy and that democratic kind of mandate that we have. Seeing some of the additional powers that the Secretary of State will have to intervene, some of the changes in Public Health England, and some of those slight shifts in dynamic around social care with sort of ability to give funding to work much closer with social care providers without going through the sort of locality lens are concerning. Every bit of the country is different. A one-size-fits-all approach really doesn't work if we're trying to tackle that longer-term sustainability.
Whilst I completely agree that obviously a one-size-fits-all approach is never going to work, obviously there's an element of, if this is going to be rolled out nationally, some form of common governance and accountability arrangements, which is something that we still don't have full clarity around from the white paper, whatever it is that's going to underpin the proposed two-board structure. What impact do you think that this is going to have on the relationship between the NHS and local government, and what do you think needs to be put in place for an effective governance model?
I think it's really important to start to understand what that potential two-board governance might look like. As you say, it's a wee bit thin on detail at the moment. I think it's moving away from seeing local government as an important but fairly amorphous mass to a deeper engagement with local government around some co-design of how those arrangements might look and involving the local government part of the equation much sooner up front. When you sort of look at some of the national arrangements, the clues in the title for Department of Health and Social Care, and it's just important that we give equal prominence to both of those things. I think alongside that, the solution to social care funding and arrangements has been in the too difficult box for well over a decade now. I can remember engagement meetings over 10 years ago around future funding arrangements for social care. What sort of models could we look at? And until that's resolved as well, I think it's always going to be difficult both to look at local authority funding per se and to fully understand the role that local government will play in the integrated care system arrangements. I'd be disappointed, I think, if that was a move to take social care into a more nationalised arrangement. The health service has been absolutely outstanding during this pandemic, but it's around interventions at points in people's lives. Social care is around the broader, deeper, looking at health inequalities, looking at people's care arrangements that could be, you know, a residential home is somebody's home. So bringing those two things together is really important. I think finally, and my concerns with the impact of the COVID pandemic, is sometimes social care is seen as that bit that's the problematic part of that, getting the hospital system to work smoothly. We are going to put huge pressure on both sectors if the focus remains on discharge and moving people into a care placement without looking at the whole system, how we tackle some of those ingrained things around why some people need care from an early age and how we can work more effectively in the community to keep people out of hospital altogether.
Sure. Bringing all that together then as a final kind of summarising point, I suppose, the next steps are going to be for government to start pushing the legislation through Parliament. So what do you think the key considerations need to be for the debate going forward?
Genuine engagement with local government as a sector, well, an understanding of what the social care funding vision for the future is. I know how difficult that is. A willingness for co-design and a willingness to tackle some of those barriers that we all have workarounds for now. You know, differences in workforce regulation, difference in VAT, difference in planning cycle timescales and how we can bring those closer together. Some of those things that just make day-to-day integration harder, as I said at the start, than it needs to be.
Great, thank you. And I mean, as you've said, Carol, the devil is very much going to be in the detail. So it'll be we'll be watching with interest to see how this develops going forward. Thank you very much for taking the time to join us today.
Thank you very much. I've enjoyed it.
You've been listening to Sit for Speaks, and thanks again to Carol for joining us. Finally, for this episode, we were hugely excited to sit down with author and former public policy editor of the Financial Times, Nicholas Timmins.
So I'm here with author and journalist Nicholas Timmins. Thank you very much for joining us today.
My pleasure.
So before we go into the questions that we're going to be talking through, Nick has kindly joined us to talk to the NHS white paper into integration a little bit. Could you give our listeners a bit of an overview of your background and your specific policy interests?
Well, my background is a journalist for 40 years. The last chunk of which, in 1996 to 2011, I was a public policy editor at the Financial Times. And these days, I'm a senior fellow at the King's Fund at the Institute for Government, do various bits of work on NHS policy and work around that and other areas.
Amazing. Thank you. So, as I said, we're here to go over the NHS white paper. Now, integration is, well, it's nothing new. Integration has been a hot policy topic for some time. But one of the takeaways from the recent pandemic, if I think silver linings is probably the wrong phrase to use, but for lack of a better one, one has been the closer collaboration between health and social care and barriers coming down very much by necessity. So before we get into the ins and outs of the white paper itself, what do you think have been the barriers to integrated care in the past? And in your view, has the pandemic been any kind of catalyst for doing things differently?
Well, I suppose the long run answer is that is that since 1948, we have had services split into hospitals, primary care, community services and social care. People have been trying to get them to work better together for a very long time. I mean, you can go back to the 1974 NHS reorganisation, which brought in a load of what were local authority services into the NHS in an attempt to get better integration. So it's been a long journey and progress has been made. But I think it is clear that the pressure of the pandemic has certainly improved the cooperation between health and social care in the short term. And that was sort of driven by force majeure and people realising they just had to get on with it and did, to all their credit. The interesting question is how far that lasts on into the future.
In a recent blog that you wrote for the Institute for Government, you did say that the proposals in the white paper threatened to take the NHS back to the wrong sort of future. So can you expand a bit on what you meant by that? And is there anything you think should be welcomed from the proposals?
Right. Well, the wrong sort of future was specifically focused around this proposal that ministries take powers of direction, back, take back powers of direction of the NHS. If you look at the long run history of the health service, the terrible centripetal forces that pull power back to the centre in the NHS. But Secretary of State on Secretary of State has tried to get out of the direct management of the service and tried, if you look at Andrew Lansley's Act, that was meant to remove ministers almost entirely, apart from setting a rolling mandate of what the NHS should achieve. So I think there are real risks in powers of direction, because if you look at what's happened with the 2012 Act, I mean, in large measure, it has been ignored and worked around. But I think most people would agree that one of the things that's come out of it that has worked has been the statutory independence of NHS England. Not in the way that Andrew Lansley envisaged, but it has been there. And with the mandate, there has been this, very difficult to prove the counterfactual. But NHS England has been able to say to ministers, well, if you want us to do this, this is what it will require. This is the resources we need. And I think it's probably fair to say there have been fewer sort of slightly daft ministerial initiatives wanting to announce we want to spend 50 million on this or 40 million on that. The other important thing, talking about integrated care, is there's been a consistency of purpose ever since 2014, in fact earlier, to drive towards better integrated care. There's not been flip-flops of policy. And I think that is in part a product of the fact that the NHS England has been a more statutorily independent body. The risk with powers of direction is that if ministers centralise responsibility, they then centralise blame, they will become more and more held accountable to the things that inevitably go wrong from time to time. And I'm not sure that's actually in their interests or necessarily in the interests of the health service itself, because you end up with getting political interference in decisions, and that's really difficult. And if you look at the two bits in the pandemic where Matthew Hancock has had direct control, they've been Public Health England and Test and Trace. And given that they've decided to break up Public Health England and Test and Trace, neither has been an outstanding success. So I think the really important question is, what is it ministers have not been able to get the NHS to do that require them to take powers of direction? And I've not heard any answer to that question. And I think it's a question that should be asked repeatedly before Parliament decides to give them powers of direction. And there's also a worry about this intervening earlier in reconfigurations, reshaping your services. And you've horrible feeling that's going to come down to very little, very particular political local pressures. There has been an arrangement that almost nobody has heard of called the Independent Reconfiguration Panel, which has been around since about 2007. Where when there are disputed reshapings of services, these can be referred to that, and an independent bunch of people takes a look at it. And classically what they do is these things go ahead, but often with some modifications, because outside eyes have suggested some modifications, and ministers simply approve it. Once they start getting involved in every little, reshaping services, I don't think that will be helpful. And again, I think they'll discover that centralising the responsibility centralises the blame. If ministers want powers of direction, they really need to explain what it is they have not been able to get the NHS to do that makes these powers a good idea.
So you've touched quite broadly there on the benefits of retaining sort of NHS's statutory independence, but do you think there is anything to be welcomed in the proposals?
Well, yes, I think there are some things to be welcomed in the proposals. I mean, the movement towards integrated care systems at some point requires a more formal arrangement than there has been to date. There's a lot of money flowing through ICSs, and there has to be an accountable officer for them at some point. So I do think trying to, and some of the powers that taking away the what you might call a compulsory tendering bit is very sensible. We still have to see in full the regime that will replace it, and you don't want to be in a position where nothing ever goes out to tender. But removing what many people see as an effective requirement to put services out to tender when it's quite clear that there's no sensible bids for them is very sensible. All that direction of travel is the right direction of travel. I think how it's all going to work is going to be quite complicated, but we'll come on to that.
Absolutely. I mean, that very much touches on my next question. So, of course, we still don't have full clarity on the governance and accountability arrangements to underpin the proposed two-board structure. So what impact do you think that will have on the relationship between NHS and local government? And do you have any of your own reflections on what effective governance would look like?
Well, I think this is genuinely difficult. I would say that one of the great strengths of the drive towards integrated care systems has been that kind of for the first time in NHS history, back in 2014, it was said, these do not have to look the same everywhere. You can devise your own solutions to getting this to work. And I think that's pretty unique. So normally you legislate and say there's got to be this, exactly this same structure everywhere across the country. So I think the flexibility has been very, very valuable. Why have we ended up with this sort of two-board structure? Well, I suspect it's because some local authorities would actually like there to be one body and they would like to be on it so that it's a genuinely integrated system at the top of the ICS. But others don't really want to lose the implied sovereignty they lose to that, because in a sense, you're combining budgets, you're to some point you have an NHS say over how local authority budgets got spent and a bit vice versa. But, you know, the NHS is the big beast in the room in terms of money. Some are reluctant to lose, in a sense, lose a degree of sovereignty, whereas others would be happy with that. So I think we've ended up with this two-board structure as an attempt to square a slightly unsquareable circle. People feel differently about it in different parts of the country. And it does all feel a bit complicated because there's not much going with the rest, disappearing as a result of this. So you will have this two-board structure. What happens when they disagree? If they disagree, not clear. You will still have foundation trusts and NHS trusts with their own accounting offices and their own requirement to balance their own budgets as they do at the moment. You'll have this new ICS partnership board, but we'll still have health and wellbeing boards and scrutiny boards. It feels like a somewhat crowded landscape in which I don't think it's yet clear how things get resolved when people don't disagree. I wouldn't want to overstate it, but one of the things that followed the 1974 reorganization was something called consensus management, where people were meant to agree on the best way forward, and that's what they would do. And of course, where people agreed, that worked perfectly. But in too many places, it gave everybody a veto, so kind of nothing much happened. I think there's a bit of a risk around that here if we're not careful.
Okay, and I think that kind of runs into my last question. It's more a summary thing than anything else. So the next steps will be for government to start pushing legislation through Parliament. What do you think the key considerations for the debate should be going forwards?
Well, clearly, I would think that we need these powers of direction clearly explaining. And I do think ministers should think again about early intervention in reconfigurations. I mean, I think the current process is very, very slow and very, very complex and could well do with refining in some way. But I'm not sure ministerial interference is the right one. And then clearly we will need some clarity around how this government is actually going to look. And the trick, I think, will be to set in legislation something that provides an overall framework but still leaves a fair degree of flexibility around the country in precisely how it works and precisely what it looks like. And that's probably doable. The other risk for the government, of course, is as soon as you get an NHS bill, it will become a Christmas tree and everybody will want to hang their particular concerns around healthcare on it. And that will be a challenge. I mean, I'm sure that will happen in the Lords. Getting it through may not be an entirely simple exercise.
Is getting any legislation through ever a simple exercise? Amazing. Well, thank you very much, Nick. That's all the questions I had for you. And thank you very much for spending some of your time to talk with us today.
My pleasure.
Thanks again to Nick for sharing his reflections with us this week. That's about all we've got time for. We hope you found this episode interesting and informative, and we'll see you again next time.